Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the appointment of a new police chief by the Porter Town Council. Justin Hicks reports Indiana will opt out of federal unemployment benefit programs effective in mid-June. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Tracy Lewis, the Executive Director of Community Advocates of Northern Indiana. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. On Wednesday, the Porter Police Department appointed a 27-year veteran as the new chief. The Times reports, the Porter Town Council affirmed Todd Allen's latest position as chief at their meeting, effective May 23rd. Allen has been serving the Porter Police Department since 1994. He served as an assistant chief under Porter's current chief, James Spanier, who recently announced his retirement from his position. With more than 30 years in law enforcement experience, Allen has also worked at the Chesterton Police Department. Spanier will continue working for the town in a new role. The superintendent for the Town of Porter Public Works Department.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A two-week delay has been announced in the federal bribery conviction sentencing of former Portage Mayor James Snyder, who is now arguing prosecutors are attempting to use inadmissible and, quote, less than accurate evidence against him. The Times reports U.S. District Judge Matthew Kennelly, who was brought in to oversee the local case, granted Snyder's request for additional time to file a more detailed response of what he claims are, quote, other inaccuracies in prosecutors' response to his call for an acquittal or at least a third trial, according to court records. Twice, Snyder was found guilty of accepting a $13,000 check from Great Lakes Peterbilt in Portage 7 years ago to corruptly influence the purchase of more than $1 million in garbage trucks. Snyder opted not to testify on his own behalf during his second trial and declined to answer questions as he left the federal court building in March following his conviction.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Crews have installed signs directing motorists to the small house in Gary that Michael Jackson and his siblings called home before the Jackson 5 achieved fame. The Times reports that Marlon Jackson and Tito Jackson joined several dignitaries last week in unveiling one of the signs outside the family's former home. The directional signs through the Indiana Department of Transportation were placed along Interstate 8094 as well as on local roads.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Indiana will opt out of federal unemployment benefit programs effective in mid-June. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports Governor Eric Holcomb is following other states in an attempt to push people back into the workforce.
Starting June 19th, Indiana will no longer pay an extra $300 in federal benefits each week for all unemployment claims. It will also completely end benefit programs for people who are self-employed or gig workers that roughly 70,000 Hoosiers are accessing. Also set to end is an extended benefit program for the longtime unemployed, another 62,000 people currently benefit from. Holcomb says the move is in response to employers complaining that they can't grow if they can't hire enough workers. He says there's just under 120,000 jobs that need to be filled. But economists say there's still no evidence unemployment benefits are by and large keeping people out of jobs. Instead, they point to stagnant wages and a lack of childcare options during the ongoing pandemic. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb is not a fan of the state using monetary incentives to push more people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Holcomb's comments come after Ohio announced it will give away millions of dollars to encourage people to get vaccinated.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced a $1 million lottery system for vaccinated Ohioans last week using federal COVID-19 relief dollars. Governor Holcomb says he's got a different approach.
I've taken an approach to try to entice people by making it uber convenient to get vaccinated and appeal to their better senses about this is how we all get through this quicker.
Holcomb says he's not comfortable with monetary incentives.
Some people will never get vaccinated, and some people might wait until they waited for that monetary enticement. So I don't want folks to wait.
According to the CDC, only 10 states are worse than Indiana in the percentage of their population with at least one shot of the vaccine. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
As vaccine rollout continues, some researchers say the country has hit a plateau in the number of people being vaccinated. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Darian Benson reports finding time off work to get vaccinated can be a barrier for many.
Indiana University Health Policy and Management Professor Ross Silverman says many people want to get vaccinated, but may not be able to take time off work.
They may be worried about going out and taking the time to get themselves or help their family members get the shot.
The Federal American Rescue Plan includes a program that allows companies under 500 employees to apply for a tax credit to give paid time off to employees for vaccine-related appointments. Silverman says this program can help combat fears workers might have about getting vaccinated. It also covers time off for any possible side effects from the shot.
This program will allow employers to get a tax credit for giving that time off to their employees. That could be a game changer.
Eligible employers can claim the tax credit for paid sick leave from April 1st through September 30th. Self-employed individuals may also claim the credit. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Darian Benson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Senator Mike Braun echoed talking points from prominent conservatives in dismissing calls to create a commission to study the January 6th U.S. Capitol insurrection. The bipartisan legislation would form a group modeled after the 9/11 commission. U.S. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell came out against forming the group, and Braun followed suit. Braun says the commission would discover nothing law enforcement agencies have not already found while investigating and charging hundreds in association with the attack. Many charged in the attacks testified under oath. They were incited by Republicans and former President Trump's calls to stop the steal. Braun, who voiced multiple public concerns over the validity of election results, ultimately certified results immediately after the insurrection.
Were there some irregularities? I found out most of our research that a lot of what had been done legally by local election commissions, local jurisdictions.
At least a half dozen Hoosiers face federal charges for their role in the attack on the Capitol.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A black woman in Indianapolis filed a complaint alleging housing discrimination after two low home appraisals spurred her to administer a fair housing test. She had a white friend stand in for her. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan filed a feature report for NPR's Morning Edition.
Carla Duffy's tidy three-bedroom home close to downtown Indianapolis is in a historic black neighborhood. It's been completely renovated and sits across the street from a park in lush green space. She bought it 4 years ago for $100,000.
My house is my forever home. I love my neighborhood. I love my home.
With a hot housing market and low interest rates, Duffy wanted to refinance her mortgage to help fix up another home for her daughter. The first appraisal came back at $125,000, and she was shocked. A recent independent market analysis had estimated her home at $187,000, so she tried again.
And then to get the second one, and it's $15,000 lower, just a few months later. I just could not fathom, you know, there was this just nagging voice in my head that was saying that there is something wrong.
Duffy had a theory and wanted to put it to the test. When she applied for refinancing with a new lender, she left her race and gender off the application. One of her friend's husbands, who is white, agreed to stand in during the third appraisal. Before he did, she took out everything that might indicate her race and left her home. She got another shock when she got that appraisal back.
I scrolled so fast, and I was just like holding my breath, scrolling and getting to the bottom of it to see the number. I'm just like, I don't even want to read it just yet. I just want to see the number.
The number, $259,000, more than double the original appraisal.
And then it just sinks in. It just set in that what was devaluing my home was me.
Carlette Duffy filed a complaint against two of the lenders with HUD. Neither would comment for this story. But the appraiser with the lowest estimate, Tim Boston, stands by his report.
Anytime I put a report out, I prepare with the intention of having to defend that report before a group of my peers. It's all data-driven, so it's inherent in the data, and I wouldn't know how to change that.
A number of studies have found that Black-owned homes are undervalued when compared to those of white homeowners. This is especially true in historically Black neighborhoods. A study by the Brookings Institution finds that adds up to $156 billion in cumulative losses for Black homeowners. Amy Nelson heads the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana and says local and federal policies that perpetuated racial segregation in the early 20th century play into the continued disparity.
It was the appraisal industry at the time that supported the very redlining maps that redlined Carlette's neighborhood and so many Black neighborhoods in our city.
Nelson says while it's hard to determine how prevalent the problem is, examples of racial bias and discrimination in the appraisal process have been discussed for years.
Just a growing number of Blacks and African Americans saying something's wrong here.
There also may be a growing desire to address this issue. HUD recently decided in favor of a complainant in a similar appraisal discrimination case. In a written statement, the American Society of Appraisers says it supports a focus on why Black homes are devalued. It adds that more education for appraisers and a more diverse workforce could be part of the solution.
That was Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reporting for NPR's Morning Edition.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Young adults face many new experiences and challenges, and that can threaten their mental health. Navigating the health system to find help also can be tough. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports.
Noelle Broughton is an accomplished student. She's in a graduate program at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and is headed for a PhD. She also struggles with anxiety and self-doubt. As a child, she had a few therapy sessions, but they didn't last. Now, at 25, she wants to try treatment again before heading to the University of Kansas for her doctorate in public administration.
But then once I actually took the step to do so, I realized how difficult it is. It feels impossible at times.
Broughton has been looking for a mental health provider who is female, a person of color, and a network. She's had no luck in the past year.
I feel like every time I find someone who checks two of those boxes, maybe they don't check the third box.
So as she prepares to move west, she questions if seeking treatment is worth it. Many other young adults face similar problems when it comes to mental health services. It's especially challenging for those who suddenly lose the support of school counselors. Jedediah Carter grew up in a rural town with limited mental health care, but family support helped him get through high school. When he moved to Indianapolis for college, he wasn't ready for the academic challenges and being on his own.
It's tough to, you know, be out as a young adult trying to navigate this brand new world for the first time.
Carter is now 24 and taking a break from school to regain control of his mental health. Finding care for depression and anxiety hasn't been easy. While taking classes, he could use IUPUI's mental health services. But now that he's not enrolled, he has lost access to them. He struggled to find a provider on his own.
It feels like you are being forgotten or left, you know, because there's nobody's returning your calls. But I was like feeling a little bit of a crisis that I needed to get this started or things were only going to get worse.
There's a term for Broughton, Carter, and others like them. They're called transitional young adults because from age 16 to 26, many graduate high school, attend college, or enter the workforce. Anita Everett of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says this all heightens the risk of mental illness.
We know that people are making decisions that could impact the rest of their lives and things like that. There's a lot of sort of stress and a lot of pressure on individuals in that age group.
Nancy Roy is a psychologist with the Jed Foundation, which supports the emotional health of young adults. She says insurance plays an important role in getting treatment.
If you do have insurance, then at least you have the structure of being able to go online or pick up the phone and call the number on the back of your card.
Roy says it can still take a long time to find a provider that is taking new patients. Another problem, there aren't enough providers. A Kaiser Family Foundation study found that in Indiana, nearly a quarter of adults with symptoms of depression or anxiety had an unmet need for counseling or therapy. And a University of Michigan study found there are only 6 psychiatrists in Indiana for every 100,000 people. Both trends line up with national data. Everett says Congress is trying to help by boosting funds for young adults who've had their first psychotic episode. Through this funding, every state has at least one program to increase access to care.
And the whole concept there is to identify that as early as possible and help those kids, those people, young adults, get back on track.
Carter spent 6 months searching for a provider. He finally made an appointment, but he knows he's lucky to still be on his parents' insurance.
I do feel like the system is way harder than it needs to be, especially for, you know, I think something that is essential.
From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Tracy Lewis.
The organization, which is called Community Advocates for Northern Indiana, or CANI, has come up with a strategic plan to be able to raise awareness about the COVID-19 vaccination in communities of color. And we have with us the executive director of the organization, Tracy Lewis, with us to give us more. Will you take a moment and explain for folks that are not familiar with your organization what the CANI is all about, and in particular with this very new and exciting initiative that is in place thanks to the help of the state and other agencies to help fight the spread of COVID-19.
Absolutely. So Community Advocates of Northern Indiana, Can I for short, has a tagline, Can I Help? We're out in the community asking where and how we can help. Our mission is to eliminate health disparities in the region, and so we do just that through a number of different projects. The one we're most excited about right now is Operation Educate, Engage, and Register, just to help to eliminate the spread and get us all back to normal by getting COVID-19 vaccinations in the arms of community members.
I know in particular that you're taking advantage of the mass vaccination pop-up clinic that's already been set up in Gary there at Roosevelt Park there on West 25th Avenue. And what are you hoping that OEER, I know is for short the operation's being called, what are you hoping to be able to accomplish with your help with that?
Well, what we're absolutely excited about doing is to accomplish, of course, eliminating health disparities. Right now, there are disparate numbers, and not as many people in communities of color are getting the vaccination. And so we're just hoping to educate and dispel myths about it in the hopes of getting those shots in the arms.
I know that there are a number of street teams that are out there. Will you tell us about the organization of that and how they are helping getting the word out, getting people to get over to Roosevelt Park to get the vaccinations?
Yes. So with the street teams, we are doing a hard target, intensive outreach, knocking on doors, going there to different grocery stores, convenience stores, apartment complexes, actually taking the information and education door to door and encouraging folks to get the shot. And if they're so willing, our street teams will register people right there on the spot.
How successful have getting word back from them as to how they're doing and getting people signed up to get the shot?
Well, we are just seeing some zip code information, and so we're experiencing some success. We'll probably end up being at the end of the program before we can definitively say just exactly how much, but the numbers are rising in each zip code that we've been in, and we like to think that has a large part to do with what we're out there working at.
You mentioned here just a moment ago about the work that the street teams are doing to get the word out, to get people signed up to be vaccinated. I know that you started in some key neighborhoods, and the Horace Mann neighborhood in particular. Will you tell us a little bit about how the door-to-door campaign got started there and working on to more neighborhoods in Gare?
Yes. So what we did there in Horace Mann, everyone just started there on 5th and Taft, and we worked our way heading east, making our way. We probably got to Grant Street from Taft, 5th and Taft to 8th and Taft, all the way over to 5th and 8th of Grant Street. And then the other thing we're doing today, we're positioning and going outside of Roosevelt. So 21st Avenue to 15th Avenue in each direction, knocking on doors. We've got some new door hangers that talk about the work that we're doing and information, but also offers incentives.
That's great.
So we've got some great incentives that we're offering as well.
Which other neighborhoods in Gary are you aiming for or the street team is working on right now?
So these are data-driven approaches, and we're working on 46402 and 46407 now because the numbers are seeming to lag there. And each week we try and make sure that we let that the data drive us on the plan that we're making about where to go.
That's great. What are you finding in the research, and as well as what the door-to-door teams are reporting back to you, are for people that are probably the most at risk for coming down with COVID-19, are there a lot of elderly, a lot of homebound that, that don't have access to knowing about the vaccination site in particular here in Gary, and you're trying to kind of fill in the gaps, as you say, to be able to let them know if they haven't known already, if they haven't gotten the word out already, that they should get the vaccine right away?
Absolutely, Chris. We are. We haven't found that the numbers are extremely high with the homebound Hoosiers. We've been, prior to this effort, working on a homebound Hoosiers effort, and I'd like to believe that we've been effective in that. The calls have slowed down quite a bit, and so it looks like that's a group that's actually receiving the vaccinations when they request them.
Yeah.
And I have to say, in addition to the work that we're doing, we connect with Dr. Janet Seabrook, who's also doing it. I understand Dr. Walker Shop, the Gary Health Department, they're also addressing and reaching out to homebound Hoosiers. So I believe now that's not an area where we have folks who are wanting to have the shot and not getting it.
That's great. That's great to hear. Are you finding that all these efforts together, along with the help that you're getting from the Gary City Health Department and the State Department of Health, are getting more people told about the fact that, of course, all the publicity that's out there? We've been doing our share of getting notices out to let people know that the mass vaccination site there at Roosevelt Park is still open. It's going to be open for several more weeks to get people vaccinated, to get them out there. Is this all helping in the overall cause to let people know that they need to get the shot, they need to get vaccinated right away, and the more people vaccinated, the quicker the pandemic can abate?
That's so true. And you're right, all of these efforts are helping. I have to also include Community Health Net with Dr. Janet Seabrook. Mm-hmm. They're doing quite a bit as well. But you're right, there's information everywhere. We can't thank you and Lakeshore enough for your help in getting that information out. What we're finding with our street teams is people know about where to go, and so access isn't an issue, but making the decision to get the shot, overcoming some of the longstanding trust issues, and there are a lot of myths out there. That's where we really feel like we're being able to be effective, and there's an opportunity to change some minds there once we share the truth about the vaccination.
Now, Tracy, is there a place online or anywhere else that people can get more information, certainly about what CanEye is doing in this particular case and trying to get the word out about the vaccination sites, or any other information that you are getting out to, about the other programs you're working on?
Absolutely. So we have our website is CanEye Help. community.org.in. We also have a Facebook page, Community Advocates of NI, on Facebook there. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram as well. All of those will be referenced at the website if folks want to contact us that way. And just for general information about the shot and to dispel any myths or anything, you know, Indiana State Department of Health, our shot.in.gov is a great one to go to as well.
Tracy Lewis is Executive Director for the Community Advocates from Northern Indiana, which is CANI for short. Thank you for being with us and bringing us up to date on how the teams are doing out there, talking to people in Gary, getting the neighborhoods galvanized and get them over to the mass vaccination site, the pop-up clinic at Groseville Park on West 25th Avenue. Thank you for being with us today.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.